There's a difference between dirt and blood, Julian said. Emma shot him a quelling look, one that said, We're here because we need something. She didn't always have to write on his skin for him to know what she was thinking. The curtains rustled, though there was no breeze. Look, we're not here to bother you, Emma said. We just want some information and we'll go.
Information isn't free, said Rook.
I've got something good for you this time, better than cash, Emma said. Avoiding Julian's eyes, she took a pale column of silvery white stone from the inside of her jacket pocket. She flushed slightly, aware of Julian's eyes on her as he realized what she was holding, an unnamed seraph blade.
What is he going to do with Adamus? Julian demanded.
Adamus that has been treated by the Iron Sisters goes for a high price at the shadow market, said Rook, not taking his eyes off Emma's prize. But it still depends on what you want to know about.
The Midnight Theater and the followers, Emma said. We want to know about them.
Rook narrowed his eyes. What do you want to know? Emma gave him a brief rundown of the events of the night before, leaving out Mark and how they'd found out about the lottery in the first place. When she was done, Rook whistled.
Casper Sterling, he said. I always thought that guy was a scumbag. Yakking on about how he was better than werewolves, better than humans, too. Can't say I'm sorry his number came up.
Johnny, Emma said severely, they're going to kill him.
An odd expression flickered across Rook's face, but it vanished quickly.
And you want me to do what about it?
They're a whole organization, Carstairs.
We need to know who their leader is, said Julian.
Belinda called him the Guardian. He's the one we need to find.
I don't know, said Rook. I'm not sure pissing off the followers is worth even Adamus.
But his eyes clung to the silvery white stuff longingly. Emma pressed the advantage.
They'll never know you had anything to do with it, she said.
But I saw you flirting with Belinda at the shadow market. She's gotta know.
Rook shook his head.
She doesn't.
Huh, Emma said.
Okay. Which of them does?
None of them. The leader's identity is totally secret. I don't even know if it's a man or a woman. The Guardian could be either, you know.
If I find out you're hiding something you know from me, Johnny, Emma said in a cold voice, there will be consequences. Diana knows I'm here. You won't be able to get me in trouble with the Clave, but I could get you in trouble, serious trouble.
Emma, forget it, Julian said in a bored voice. He doesn't know anything. Let's take the Adamus and go.
They get 2 days, Rook said in a thin, angry voice, when their numbers get picked. They get 2 days before the kill has to happen.
He glared at them both, as if somehow this was their fault.
It's sympathetic magic. The energy of the death of a supernatural creature powers the spell that makes them all stronger. And the leader, he shows up for the kill. That much I know. If you're there for the death, you'll see him, or her, whoever it is.
The Guardian shows up at the murder, Emma said, to harvest the energy?
So if we shadow Sterling, if we wait for someone to attack him, we'll see the Guardian, Julian said.
Yeah, that should work. I mean, you're crazy to want to be there at some big dark magic party, but I guess it's your business.
I guess it is, Julian said.
His phone buzzed again.
Livy won't tell me anything. She's locked herself in her room. Help!
A tendril of worry uncurled in Julian's stomach. He told himself he was being stupid. He knew he worried about his siblings too much. Ty had probably wandered off after an animal, was petting a squirrel or cuddling a stray cat. Or he might have shut himself away with a book, not wanting to socialize. Julian thumbed out a response. Go outside and look for him in the back garden.
Still texting, said Rook, a mocking tone to his voice. I'm guessing you have a pretty rich social life.
I wouldn't worry, said Julian. My phone's almost out of battery.
The phone whirred again. Headed outside, it said. And then the screen went black. He shoved it into his pocket as an enormous crash sounded from downstairs, and after it the sound of a bitten-off cry.
What the hell? Said Rook.
The shock in his voice was real. Emma must have heard it too, because she was already moving toward the steps that led downstairs. Rook shouted after them, but Julian knew it would take him a moment to free himself from his protection circle. Without another glance at Rook, he darted after Emma. Kit Rook pressed himself into the shadow of the stairwell. Voices filtered down from upstairs, along with dim sunlight. His father always sent him down into the cellar when they had visitors,
especially the kind of visitors that had him running for his chalk so he could draw a protection circle. Kid could only see shadows moving upstairs, but he could hear two voices, young voices, to his surprise, a boy's and a girl's. He had a pretty good idea what they were, and it wasn't downworlders. He'd seen the look on his father's face when they'd knocked on the door. Rook hadn't said anything, but he wore that expression for only one thing, shadow hunters. Nephilim. Kid felt a slow burn of anger start in his stomach. He'd been sitting on the sofa watching TV, and now he was crouched in the basement like a thief in his own home, because shadow hunters thought they had the right to legislate magic, to tell everyone what to do, too. A figure hurtled at him out of the shadows. It hit him hard in the chest, and he staggered back and slammed into the wall behind him, breath knocked out of his body. He gasped as light flared up all around him, pale white light held in the cup of a human hand. Something sharp kissed the base of Kit's throat. He sucked in air and raised his eyes. He was staring right at a boy his own age, ink-black hair and eyes the color of the edge of a knife, eyes that darted away from his as the boy scowled. He had a long, thin, black-clad body and pale skin marked all over with the runes of the Nephilim. Kit had never been this close to a shadow hunter. The boy had one hand on his glowing light. It wasn't a flashlight or anything electronic. Kit knew magic when he saw it, and the other gripped a dagger whose point rested against Kit's throat. Kit had imagined before what he'd do if a Nephilim ever grabbed him, how he'd stomp on their feet, break their bones, snap their wrists, spit in their faces. He did none of those things, thought of none of those things. He looked at the boy with the knife to his throat, the boy whose black eyelashes feathered down against his cheekbones as he glanced away from Kit, and he felt something like a shock of recognition pass through him. He thought, how beautiful. Kit blinked. Though the boy wasn't looking directly at him, he seemed to note the movement. In a harsh whisper, he demanded, "Who are you? What are you doing here? You're too young to be Johnny Rook." His voice was lovely, clear and low, with a rasp to it that made him sound older than he was, a rich boy's voice. "No," said Kit. He felt dazed and puzzled, as if a bright camera flash had gone off in his eyes. "I'm not." The boy still wasn't looking directly at Kit, as if Kit weren't worth looking at. Kit's dazed feeling was starting to fade, to be replaced by anger. "Go on," Kit said, challenging. "Figure it out." The boy's expression clouded, then cleared. "You're his son," he said. "Johnny Rook's son." And then his lip did curl. Just the slightest curl of contempt, and anger boiled up in Kit. He jerked aside fast, away from the dagger, and kicked out. The other boy spun, but Kit caught him with a glancing blow. He heard a cry of pain. The light tumbled from the boy's hand, winking out, and then Kit was being shoved up against the wall again, a hand scrabbling to fist itself in his shirt, and the dagger was back at his throat, and the other boy was whispering, "Be quiet, be quiet, be quiet," and then the room was full of light. The other boy froze. Kit looked up to see two other shadow hunters standing on the cellar steps, a boy with blazing blue-green eyes and the blonde girl he had seen at the shadow market the week before. They were both staring. Not at him, but at the boy gripping his shirt. The boy winced but held his ground, defiance chasing alarm across his face. "Aha," Kit thought with dawning realization. "You're not supposed to be down here, are you?" "Tiberius Blackthorn," said the boy with blue-green eyes. "What on earth are you doing?" Emma stood and gawked at Ty, completely brought up short. It was as if the Institute had suddenly appeared in the middle of Johnny Rook's cellar. The sight of Ty was familiar and yet totally incongruous. Ty looked rumpled and more frazzled than she'd seen him in years, though his grip on his dagger was steady. Diana would have been pleased. She would have probably not have been pleased that he was pointing it at the throat of a mundane boy. He looked about 15 and oddly familiar. She'd seen him before, Emma realized, at the shadow market. His hair was a mass of blonde tangles. His shirt was clean but ragged, his jeans worn to a faded pallor. And he looked ready to punch Ty in the face, which was unusual for a mundane in his position. Most of them were much more unsettled by a knife to the throat. "Ty," Julian said again. He looked furious, fury with an edge of panic. "Ty, let go of Johnny Rook's son." The blonde boy's eyes widened. How do you know who I am?" he demanded. Julian shrugged. "Who else would you be?" He tilted his head to the side. "Maybe you know something about the lottery at the Midnight Theater." "Jules," Emma said, "he's just a kid." "I'm not a kid," the boy protested, "and my name is Kit." "We're trying to help," Julian said. The blonde boy, Kit, scowled. Julian softened his voice. "We're trying to save lives. My father told me that's what shadow hunters always say.
Do you believe everything he says?
He was right this time, wasn't he? Kit pointed out.
His gaze slid to Emma. She remembered noticing that he had the sight. She thought he was Rook's assistant, though, not his son. They looked nothing alike.
You said it.
I meant, Julian began.
I don't know anything about a lottery, Kit snapped.
He glanced at Tiberius. What was odder, perhaps, was that Ty was looking at him. Emma remembered Ty years ago saying, "Why do people say look at me when they mean look at my eyes? You could be looking at any part of a person, you're still looking at them." But he was looking curiously at Kit's eyes as if they reminded him of something.
Kit!
The voice was a roar. Emma heard skidding footsteps on the stairs and Johnny Rook appeared. One of his sleeves was singed. Emma had never seen him look so furious.
Leave my son alone!
Ty steadied his grip on the knife, straightening his spine. He faced Johnny Rook without a speck of fear.
Tell us about the lottery, he said.
Kit winced. Emma could see it, even in the gloom. Ty didn't seem frightening to her, but then she'd cuddled him when he was 3 years old. But fear was clear in Johnny Rook's face. As far as he was concerned, Nephilim had snuck a shadow hunter into his basement to murder his son.
I'll give you Casper Sterling's address, he said as Kit stared at him, looking bewildered.
Clearly, he had rarely seen his father so shaken.
I've got it, okay? He's got a bunch of identities. He isn't easy to find, but I know where he lives. All right, good enough? Let my son go.
Ty lowered the knife and stepped back. He kept it in his hand, his eyes on Kit, as the other boy rubbed ruefully at the dent in his throat.
Dad, I... Kit started.
Be quiet, Kit, Johnny Rook snapped. I've told you, don't say anything in front of Nephilim.
We're on the same side, Julian said in his calmest voice.
Johnny Rook whirled on him, his face was red, his throat working.
Don't you dare tell me what side I'm on. You know nothing, nothing.
Enough, Emma shouted. By the angel, what are you so frightened of? Johnny slammed his mouth shut.
I'm not frightened, he said through his teeth. Just get out, he said. Get out, and don't ever come here again. I'll text you the address, but after that, don't call, don't ask me for favors. We're done, Nephilim.
Fine, Emma said, gesturing for Ty to come toward her and Julian. We'll go. Ty. Ty slid the knife he'd been holding into his belt and darted up the steps. Julian turned and went after him. The boy at the bottom of the stairs didn't watch them go. His eyes were fixed on his father. He wasn't much younger than Emma, maybe by a year or two, but she felt a sudden inexplicable surge of protectiveness toward Johnny Rook's son. If he had the sight, then all of Downworld was open to him, terrifying and inexplicable. In his own way, he was like Tiberius, living in a world he saw differently than everyone else.
Fine, Johnny, Emma said again loudly. But if you change your mind, you have my number in your phone, under Carstairs.
Johnny Rook glared at her.
Call me, Emma said again, and this time she looked directly at Kit. If you ever need anything. Get out!
Rook looked as if he were going to explode or have a heart attack, so with a last look over her shoulder, Emma went. Emma found Ty out by the car. Clouds had gathered, scudding in quick bursts across the sky. Ty was leaning against the trunk, the wind ruffling his black hair.
"Where's Jules?" she asked as she got close.
"Over there," he pointed. "I got into the house with an open rune. I broke the lock on the basement door. He's fixing it." Emma glanced over toward Johnny Rook's and saw Jules' lean, long figure outlined by the stuccoed wall. She opened the trunk of the car, unbuckling her weapons belt. "How did you get here, anyway?"
"I hid in the back seat, under the blanket," Ty pointed.
Emma could see the edge of a pair of headphones peeking out from under the quilt's fuzzy edge.
You think Julian's mad at me?
With the knife put away, he looked very young, his gray eyes clear and open, fixed on the clouds overhead.
Ty, Emma sighed, he's going to murderate you.
Julian was heading back toward them.
Ty said, that's a neologism.
Emma blinked. It's a what?
A word you made up. Shakespeare made up words all the time.
Emma smiled at him, oddly touched. Well, murderate isn't exactly Shakespeare. Ty braced himself as Julian walked directly up to him, not breaking stride, his jaw set, his blue-green eyes as dark as the deep part of the ocean. He reached Ty and caught hold of him, pulling him into a fierce hug. He pressed his face down into his little brother's black hair as Ty stood, frozen and astonished at Julian's lack of anger.
Jules, he said, are you all right?
Julian's shoulders shook. He held his little brother tighter, as if he could crush Ty into himself, into a place where he'd always be safe. He put his cheek against Ty's curls, squeezing his eyes shut, his voice muffled.
"I thought something happened to you," he said. "I thought Johnny Rook might..."
He didn't finish his sentence. Ty put his arms carefully around Julian. He patted his back, gently, with his slender hands. It was the first time Emma had seen Ty comfort his older brother. Almost the first time she'd ever actually seen Julian let someone else take care of him. They were silent on the long highway drive back to the Institute. Silent as the clouds cleared away, blown inland by the ocean air. The sun was low on the water as they drove up the Pacific Coast Highway. They were silent as they got out of the car and Julian finally really spoke.
"You shouldn't have done that," he said, looking at Tiberius. He'd stopped shaking, thankfully, since he'd been driving, and his voice was steady and soft.
"It was too dangerous for you to come with us."
Ty put his hands in his pockets. "I know what you think, but this is my investigation, too."
"Mark texted me to tell me you were missing," Julian said, and Emma started. She should have guessed that was what all the business with Jules's phone had been about.
"I almost walked right out of Rook's house. I don't think he would have let us back in."
"I'm sorry you were worried," said Ty.
"That's why I hugged you outside Rook's house, because I was sorry you were worried.
But I'm not Tavi. I'm not a child. I don't need to always be there so that you or Mark can find me."
"You shouldn't have come into Rook's house either," Julian's voice rose. "It wasn't safe."
"I wasn't planning to come inside. Just a look at the house, observe it." Ty's soft mouth hardened.
"Then I saw you go in, and I saw someone moving around downstairs. I thought they might come up and attack you when you didn't expect it. I knew you didn't realize anyone was down there."
"Jules," Emma said, "you would have done the same thing."
Jules shot her an exasperated look.
"Ty's only 15.
"Don't say it's dangerous because I'm 15, Ty said. "You did things just as dangerous when you were 15. And Rook wouldn't have told you Sterling's address if I hadn't been holding a knife on his son."
"That's true," said Emma. "He got into that protection circle too fast."
"You couldn't have known he had a son hidden down there," Julian said. "You couldn't have predicted what would happen, Ty. It was luck."
"Prediction is magic," Ty said. "It wasn't that, and it wasn't luck either. I've heard Emma talk about Rook. Diana, too. He sounded like someone who would hide things, who you couldn't trust, and I was right."
He looked hard at Jules. He wasn't looking him in the eye, but his gaze was direct.
"You always want to protect me," he said. "But you won't ever tell me when I'm right. If you let me make decisions on my own, maybe you'd worry about me less."
Julian looked stunned.
"It could help that we know Rook has a son," said Ty. He spoke with a clear confidence.
"You can't be sure it won't. And I got you Sterling's address. I helped, even if you didn't want me there."
In the dim light spilling down from the Institute, Julian looked as vulnerable as Emma had ever seen him.
"I'm sorry," he said almost formally. "I didn't mean to make it sound like you didn't help."
"I know the law," said Ty. "I know 15 isn't grown up. I know we need Uncle Arthur and we need you," he frowned.
"I mean, I can't cook at all, and neither can Livy. And I wouldn't know how to put Tavi to bed.
I'm not saying you need to put me in charge or let me do whatever I want. I know there are rules. But some things, maybe Mark could do them?"
"But Mark," Julian began, and Emma knew his fear.
"Mark might not stay. He might not want to."
"Mark's just getting to know you all again and know what it's like being here," Julian said. "I don't know if we could ask him to do too much."
"He wouldn't mind," said Ty. "He likes me. He likes us."
"He loves you," said Julian,
"and I love you too.
But Ty, Mark might not...
If we don't find the killer, Mark might not be able to stay here."
"That's why I want to help solve the mystery," said Ty, "so Mark can stay. He could take care of us, and you could rest."
He pulled his jacket closed, shivering. The wind off the ocean was intensely cool.
"I'm going to go inside and find Livy. Mark, too. He was probably worried."
Julian stared after Ty as he went into the house. The look on his face, it was as if Emma were looking at one of his paintings, but crumpled and torn, the colors and lines jumbled.
"They all think that, don't they?" he said slowly. "They all think Mark is going to stay."
Emma hesitated. A few days before, she would have told Julian not to be ridiculous, that Mark would stay with his family no matter what. but she had seen the night sky in Mark's eyes when he talked of the hunt, heard the cold freedom in his voice. There were two Marks, she thought sometimes, the human and the fairy. Human Mark would stay, fairy Mark could not be predicted.
How could they not? Emma said. If I got one of my parents back somehow, and then thought they were going to leave again, voluntarily.
Julian looked ashen. We live in a world of demons and monsters, and the thing that scares me the most is the idea that Mark might decide he belongs with the Wild Hunt and leave. Even if we solve the mystery and satisfy the fair folk, he might still go, and he'll smash their hearts to pieces. They'll never recover. Emma moved closer to Julian, laying a hand against his shoulder.
You can't protect the kids against everything, she said. They have to live in the world and deal with what happens in the world.
And that means loss sometimes. If Mark chooses to leave, it'll be awful, but they're strong kids, they'll live through it.
There was a long silence. Finally, Julian spoke.
Sometimes I almost wish Mark hadn't come back, he said in a dry, tense voice.
What does that make me?
H-U-M-A-N. Emma traced on his back, and for a moment he leaned into her, seeming to draw comfort from her, the way Parabatai were supposed to. The noises of the desert dimmed around them. It was something Parabatai could do, create a quiet space where there was nothing but themselves and the live connection of magic that bound them.
A loud crash broke through the silence. Julian drew away from Emma with a start. There was another crash, clearly coming from inside the Institute. Julian spun around. A moment later, he was racing up the back steps of the house.
Emma followed him. There was more noise. She could hear it even on the staircase, the clanging of dishware, the sound of laughing voices. They hurried upstairs, side by side. Emma reached the kitchen first and swung the door open. She gasped.
17. The Demons Down Under the Sea. It looked as if the kitchen had exploded. The refrigerator had been emptied out. Ketchup decorated its once white surface in scarlet swirls. One of the pantry doors was hanging off its hinges. The Costco tub of maple syrup had been dragged out, and syrup covered almost every available surface. A massive bag of powdered sugar had been torn open, and Tavi was sitting inside it, completely covered in white powder. He looked like a tiny, abominable snowman. Mark seemed to have tried cooking, since there were pans on the stove, filled with burned substances that were pouring smoke into the air. The flames were still on. Julian darted to turn them off while Emma stared. Julian's kitchen, which he'd stocked with food for 5 years, kept clean and cooked in, made pancakes in, was destroyed. Bags of candy had been ripped open and littered the floor. Drew was sitting on the counter, poking at a glass of something foul-looking and humming happily to herself. Livy was curled up on one of the bench seats, giggling, a stick of licorice in her hand. Ty was beside her, licking a speck of sugar from the back of his wrist. Mark emerged from the pantry wearing a white apron with red hearts on it and carrying 2 pieces of singed bread. "Toast," he announced happily, before catching sight of Julian and Emma. There was a silence. Julian appeared to be struggling for words. Emma found herself backing toward the door. She had suddenly remembered the fights Mark and Julian used to have when they were children. They had been vicious and bloody in scope, and Julian had given as good as he got. In fact, sometimes he'd given before he got. Mark raised his eyebrows.
Toast?
That's my toast, Ty pointed out.
Right.
Mark crossed the room, side-eyeing Julian as he went. Julian was still wordless, slumped against the stove.
And what do you want on your toast?
Pudding, Ty said promptly.
Pudding,
Julian echoed. Emma had to admit that when she'd imagined the first word Julian was going to say out loud in the situation, it hadn't been pudding.
Why not pudding?
Livy said equably, locating a container of tapioca pudding and handing it to her twin, who began to spoon it onto the bread in measured doses. Julian turned to Mark.
I thought you said she was locked in her room.
She came out when you guys texted that you found Ty, said Mark.
There didn't seem to be any reason not to, said Livy.
And why is the toaster in the pantry? Julian said.
I couldn't find any other... Mark seemed to be searching for words.
Electrical outlets.
And why is Tavi in a bag of sugar? Mark shrugged.
He wanted to be in a bag of sugar.
That doesn't mean you should put him in a bag of sugar, Julian's voice rose. Or practically destroy the stove. Or let Drusilla drink. What is in that glass, Drew?
Chocolate milk, Drew said promptly, with sour cream and Pepsi. Julian sighed.
She shouldn't be drinking that.
Why not? Mark untied the apron around his waist and flung it aside. I do not understand the source of your anger, brother. They're all alive, aren't they?
That's a pretty low bar, Julian said. If I'd realized all you thought you had to do was keep them alive.
That's what you said, Mark said, half angry and half bewildered. You joked about it, said they could take care of themselves.
They can!
Julian had risen to his full height. He seemed suddenly to tower over Mark, bigger and broader and altogether more adult than his brother.
You're the one causing the chaos. You're the older brother. Do you even know what that means? You're meant to take better care of us than this.
Jules, it's fine, Livy said. We're fine.
Fine? Julian echoed. Ty sneaked out, and I'll talk to you about that later, Livia. Got into Johnny Rook's house and held his son at knife point. Livy locked herself in her room, and Tavi is possibly permanently coated in sugar. As for Drew, we've got about 5 minutes until she throws up.
I won't, Drew said, scowling.
I'll clean it, Mark said.
You don't know how!
Julian was white-faced and furious. Emma had rarely seen him so angry.
You, he said, looking at Mark. You used to look after them, but I guess you've forgotten that. Guess you've forgotten how to do anything normal.
Mark flinched. Tiberius stood up, his gray eyes burned in his pale face. His hands were moving at his sides, fluttering. Moth's wings, wings that could hold a knife, could cut a throat.
Stop, he said.
Emma didn't know whether he was talking to Julian, to Mark, or to the room in general, but she saw Julian freeze. She felt her heart contract as he looked around the room at his brothers and sisters. Drew sat unmoving. Tavi had climbed out of the sugar and was gazing at Julian with his wide blue-green eyes. Mark was unmoving, his face pale, color striping the high cheekbones that marked out his fairy heritage. There was love in his family's eyes as they looked at Julian, and worry and fear, but Emma wondered if Jules could see any of it. If all he saw was the children he had given up so much of his life for, happy with someone else. If, like her, he looked at the kitchen and remembered how he had taught himself to clean it when he was 12 years old. Taught himself to cook. Simple things at first. Spaghetti and butter, toast and cheese. 1,000,000 cheese sandwiches. 1,000,000 burns on Julian's hands and wrists from the stove and the spatter. The way he'd walk down the path to the highway every few days to accept the grocery delivery, before he could drive. The way he dragged and carried all their food back up the hill. Julian on his knees, skinny in jeans and sweatshirt, scrubbing the floor. The kitchen had been designed by his mother. It was a piece of her, but it was also a piece of everything he'd given over the years to his family. And he would do it again, Emma thought. Of course he would. He loved them that fiercely. The only thing that made Julian angry was fear. Fear for his sisters and brothers. He was afraid now, though Emma wasn't sure why. She saw only the look on his face as he registered their resentment of him, their disappointment. The fire seemed to go out of him. He slid down the front of the stove until he was sitting on the floor.
Jules?
It was Tavi, white granules coating his hair. He shuffled close and put his arms around Julian's neck. Jules made an odd sound, and then he pulled his brother in and hugged him fiercely. Sugar sifted down onto his black gear, dusting it with white powder. The kitchen door opened, and Emma heard a gasp of surprise. She turned and saw Christina gaping at the mess.
Che disastre!
It didn't exactly require a translation. Mark cleared his throat and began stacking dirty dishes in the sink. Not so much stacking them as flinging them, really. Livy went over to help him while Christina stared.
Where's Diana? Emma asked.
She's home.
Malcolm portaled us there and back,
said Christina, not taking her eyes off the charred pots on the stove. She says she needed to catch up on sleep. Still holding Tavi, Julian stood up. There was powdered sugar on his shirt, in his hair, but his face was calm, expressionless.
Sorry about the mess, Christina.
It's fine, she said, looking around the room. It is not my kitchen, though, she added hastily. I can help you clean up.
Mark will clean up, Julian said, without looking at his brother. Did you and Diana find anything out for Malcolm?
He had gone to see some warlocks he thought might be able to help, said Christina. We talked about Katerina Loss. I've heard of her. She teaches at the academy sometimes, Downworlder studies. Apparently both Malcolm and Diana are good friends with her, so they exchanged a lot of stories I didn't really understand. Well, here's what we learned from Rook, said Emma, and launched into the story, leaving out the part where Ty had almost sliced off Kit Rook's head. So someone needs to tail Sterling, said Livy eagerly when Emma was done. Ty and I could do it. You can't drive, Emma pointed out, and we need you here for research. Livy made a face. So we get stuck here reading It Was Many and Many a Year Ago 9,000 times? There's no reason we can't learn to drive, said Ty, looking mulish. Mark was saying, it's not like it matters that we're not 16. It's not as if we have to obey mundane laws anyway.
Did Mark say that? Julian said quietly.
Fine. Mark can teach you how to drive.
Mark dropped a plate into the sink with a crash.
Julian.
What is it, Mark? Said Jules.
Oh, right. You don't actually know how to drive either. And of course, teaching someone how to drive takes time. But you might not actually be here, because there's no guarantee you're staying.
That's not true, Livy said.
We've practically solved the case.
But Mark has a choice.
Julian was looking at his older brother over his baby brother's head. His blue-green gaze was a steady fire.
Tell them, Mark. Tell them you're sure you'll choose us.
Promise them, his gaze said. Promise them you won't hurt them.
Mark said nothing.
Oh, Emma thought. She remembered what Julian had said to her outside. This was what he was afraid of, that they loved Mark too much already. He would give up the children he loved to Mark without a murmur, if it was what they wanted. If, as Ty had said, they wanted Mark to take care of them. He would give them up because he loved them, because their happiness was his, because they were his breath and blood. But Mark was his brother, too, and he loved him as well.
What did you do, what could you do, when what threatened the ones you loved was something else you loved just as much?
Julian!
To everyone's surprise, it was Uncle Arthur standing in the doorway. He cast a brief, uninterested look over the mess in the kitchen, before zeroing in on his nephew.
Julian, I need to talk to you about something, privately.
Faint worry flickered in the back of Julian's eyes. He nodded to his uncle just as something buzzed in Emma's pocket. Her phone. Her stomach clenched. It was only two words, not from a number but from a series of zeros. The Convergence. Something had tripped the monitor at the Convergence site. Her mind raced. It was nearly sunset. The Convergence door would be opening, but the Mantids would be stirring as well. She needed to leave immediately to get there at the safest time.
Did someone call you? Julian asked, glancing over at her.
He was setting down Tavi, ruffling his hair, gently pushing him toward Drew, who was looking distinctly green. Emma stifled a frown. Wouldn't the message have gone to him, too? Or not? She remembered him saying that his phone was nearly dead back at Johnny Rook's. And Diana was asleep. Emma realized she might well be the only person here who had received the Convergence message.
Just Cameron, she said, grabbing for the first available name she could think of.
Jules' eyes shuddered. Maybe he was still worried she was going to tell Cameron about Mark. He looked pale. His expression was calm, but she could feel a tense misery coming off him in waves. She thought of the way he had clung to Ty in front of Johnny Rook's house, the way he had looked at Mark, at Arthur. Her training said she should bring Julian with her to the Convergence. He was her parabatai. But she couldn't tear him away from his family right now. She just couldn't. Her mind rebelled against the thought in a way she couldn't bring herself to examine too closely.
Christina, she turned to her friend, can I talk to you in the hallway?
With a worried look, Christina followed Emma out into the corridor.
Is this about Cameron? Christina said as soon as the kitchen door shut behind them. I do not think I'm up to giving any romantic advice right now.
I do have to go see Cameron, Emma said, her mind working quickly. She could bring Christina with her to the Convergence. Christina was trustworthy. She wouldn't mention to anyone what they were doing. But Julian had been so clearly hurt, not just hurt, gutted, by her going to the cave alone with Mark and not telling him. And so much had strained and troubled their parabatai relationship, she couldn't do it to him again by bringing someone else with her.
But it's not that. Look, someone needs to tail Sterling. I don't think anything's going to happen with him. We're still within the window of 2 days, but just in case.
Christina nodded. I can do it. Diana left the truck. I'll take it. I need the address, though.
Julian has it, and I'll give you a note for him.
Good, because he'll ask, said Christina dryly.
There was a sudden terrible noise from the kitchen,
the sound of Drew running across the kitchen floor and throwing up noisily into the sink.
Oh, poor girl, said Emma. But I mean, that thing she drank was really disgusting.
Emma, I know that you're not telling me the truth. I know you're not going to see Cameron Ashdown. Christina held up a hand, stifling Emma's protest.
And it is all right. You would not lie to me without good reason. It's just...
Yes, Emma said.
She tried to keep her eyes guileless. It was better, she told herself. If Diana caught her, if she got in trouble, she'd be the only one who did. Christina and Julian didn't deserve that. She could weather it on her own.
Be careful, Christina said. Don't make me regret lying for you, Emma Carstairs.
The sun was a brilliant ball of flame out over the ocean as Emma steered the Toyota up the dirt road that led to the convergence. The sky was darkening fast. The Toyota bumped the last few yards over the field, nearly rolling into a shallow ditch before she braked and cut the engine. She got out, reaching back inside to pull out weapons. She had left Cortana back at the Institute. It had caused her a pang, but walking out with it strapped to her back would have invited questions. At least there were serif blades. She tucked one into her belt and thumbed her witchlight stone out of her pocket, glancing around as she did. It was oddly quiet here, with no sound of insects, small animals, or birdsong. Only the wind and the grass. The mantid demons. At night, they probably came out and ate everything living. She shuddered and strode toward the cave. The convergence entrance was opening, a thick black line against the granite. She glanced back once, worriedly. The sun was lower than she would have liked, dyeing the ocean water bloody. She'd parked as close as she could to the cave entrance, so that if it was dark when she emerged, she could get to the car quickly. It was looking more and more likely that she'd have to kill some mantids on the way, though. As she strode toward the sheer wall of rock, the black line widened a little more as if welcoming her. She leaned against the rock with one hand, peering into the gap. It smelled oddly of seawater. She thought of her parents. Please let me find something, she prayed. Please let me find a clue, discover how this connects to what was done to you. Please let me avenge you. So I can sleep at night. Inside the gap, Emma could see the dim gleam of the rock corridor leading into the cave's heart. Gripping her witchlight, Emma plunged into the convergence. Night had nearly fallen. The sky was shading from blue to indigo, the first stars twinkling out above the distant mountains. Christina sat with her legs up on the dashboard of the truck, eyes fixed on the two-story ranch house that belonged to Casper Sterling. The jeep she recognized was parked in the court in front of the house, under an old-growth olive tree. A low wall ran around the property. The neighborhood, just beside Hancock Park, was full of expensive but not particularly showy houses. Sterling's was closed, shuttered, and dark. The only evidence she had that he was home was the car in the driveway. She thought of Mark, then wished she hadn't. She was doing that a lot these days, thinking of Mark and then regretting it. She had worked hard to return her life to normal after she left Mexico. No more romances with brooding and troubled men, no matter how handsome. Mark Blackthorne wasn't brooding or troubled, exactly. But Mark Blackthorne belonged to Kieran and the Wild Hunt. Mark Blackthorne had a divided heart. He also had a soft, husky voice, startling eyes, and a habit of saying things that turned her world backward. And he was an excellent dancer, from what she'd seen. Christina rated dancing highly. Boys who could dance well kissed well. That was what her mother always said. A dark shadow ran across the roof of Sterling's house. Christina was up and out of the car in seconds, her serif blade in her hand. Miguel, she whispered, and it blazed up. She was heavily glamored enough that she knew no mundane could see her, but the blade provided precious light. She moved forward carefully, her heart pounding. She remembered what Emma had told her about the night Julian had been shot. The shadow on the roof, the man in black. She eased up to the house itself. The windows were dark, the curtains motionless. Everything was still and silent. She moved toward the jeep. She slipped her steely out of her pocket just as a shape dropped to the ground beside her with an oomph. Christina leaped out of the way as a shadow unfolded. It was Sterling, dressed in what Christina imagined Mundane's thought gear looked like. Black pants, black boots, a tailored black jacket. He stared at her, and his face turned slowly purple. You, he snarled. I can help you, Christina said, keeping her voice and her blade steady. Please let me help you. The hatred in his eyes startled her.
Get away, he hissed, and yanked something out of his pocket. A gun. A handgun, small caliber, but enough to make Christina step back. Guns were something that rarely entered Shadow Hunter life. They belonged to mundanes, to their world of ordinary human crime. But they could still spill Shadow Hunter blood and split Shadow Hunter bones. He backed away, pointed the gun at her until he reached the end of his driveway. Then he turned and ran. Christina bolted after him, but by the time she'd reached the end of the driveway, he was disappearing around the corner of the street. Apparently, he hadn't exaggerated. Wares really were faster than humans, faster even than Shadow Hunters. Christina muttered a mild curse and trudged back to the Jeep. She drew her steely from her belt with her free hand and, crouching down, carefully marked a small tracking rune into the side of the vehicle just above the wheel. It wasn't a total disaster, she thought, trudging back to the truck. As Emma said, they were still within the two-day window before the hunt began. And having a tracking rune on Sterling's car was sure to help. If they just stayed away from his house, let him think they'd given up, hopefully he'd get careless and start driving. Only when she climbed into the truck and slammed the door behind her did she see that her phone was flashing. She'd missed a call. She picked it up and her heart fell into her stomach. Diego Rocio Rosales. She dropped the phone as if it had turned into a scorpion. Why would Diego call her? She told him never to speak to her again. Her hand stole to the charm at her throat and she clutched it, her lips moving in a silent prayer. Give me the strength not to call him back. Are you feeling better, Uncle? Julian said. Arthur slumped behind a desk in his office, looked up with faded, distant eyes. Julian, he said, I need to talk to you. I know. You said, Julian leaned back against a wall. Do you remember what it was about? He felt exhausted, scraped out, hollow as a dry bone. He knew he should regret what he'd said in the kitchen about Mark. He knew he should be sympathetic to his uncle, but he couldn't dredge up the emotion. He didn't really remember leaving the kitchen. He recalled handing Tavi off, as much as you could hand off a sugar-coated seven-year-old. He recalled them all promising they would clean up their dinner of cheese and chocolate and brownies and burned things. Even Drew, once she'd stopped throwing up into the sink, had sworn she'd scrub the floor and get the ketchup off the windows. Not that Julian had realized until that moment that there was ketchup on the windows. He'd nodded and gone to leave the room, and then stopped to look around for Emma. But at some point Emma had left with Christina. Presumably they were somewhere talking about Cameron Ashdown, and there was nothing Julian wanted less than to join in on that. He didn't know when that had happened, that the thought of Cameron made him not want to see Emma. His Emma. You always wanted to see your Parabatai. They were the most welcome face in the world to you. There was a wrongness about not wanting it, as if the earth had suddenly started spinning in the other direction. I don't think I do, Arthur said after a moment. There was something I wanted to help with. Something about the investigation. You are still investigating, aren't you? The murders? The ones the ferry convoy came to us about? Yes. I think it was about the poem, Arthur said. The one Livia was reciting in the kitchen. He rubbed at his eyes, obviously tired. I was passing by and I heard it. The poem, Julian echoed, confused. Annabel Lee? Arthur spoke in his deep, rumbling voice, sounding out the lines of poetry as if they were lines of a spell. But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we, and neither the angels in heaven above, nor the demons down under the sea, can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee. I know the poem, Julian interrupted, but I don't— Those who were older, Arthur said. I've heard the phrase before. In London. I can't remember what it was in connection with. He picked up a pen from the desk, tapped it against the wood. I'm sorry, I can't remember. Those who are older, murmured Julian. He remembered Belinda back at the theater, smiling with her blood-red lips. May those who are older grant us all good fortune, she'd said. An idea bloomed in the back of Julian's mind, but elusive, disappeared when he tried to chase it. He needed to go to his studio. He wanted to be alone, and painting would unlock his thoughts. He turned to go and only paused when Uncle Arthur's voice cut through the dusty air. "Did I help you, boy?" he said. "Yes," said Julian. "You helped."
When Christina returned to the Institute, it was dark and silent. The entryway lights were off, and only a few windows glowed. Julian's studio, the bright spot of the attic, the square that was the kitchen. Frowning, Christina went directly there, wondering if Emma had returned yet from her mysterious errand, if the others had managed to clean up the mess they'd made. At first glance, the kitchen seemed deserted, only a single light on. Dishes were piled in the sink, and though someone had clearly scrubbed the walls and counters, there was still food crusted onto the stove and two large trash bags, stuffed full and half-spilling, their contents propped against the wall. Christina. She blinked into the dimness, though there was no mistaking the voice. Mark. He was sitting on the floor, his legs crossed. Tavi was asleep beside him, on him, really, his head resting in the crook of Mark's arm, his small legs and arms curled up like a potato bug's. Mark's t-shirt and jeans were covered with powdered sugar. Christina slowly unwound her scarf and placed it on the table. "Has Emma returned yet?" "I don't know," Mark said, his hand carefully stroking Tavi's hair. "But if she has, she's probably gone to sleep." Christina sighed. She'd probably have to wait until tomorrow to see Emma, find out what she'd been doing. Tell her about Diego's phone call if she could get up the nerve. "Could you, if you don't mind, get me a glass of water?" Mark asked. He looked down half apologetically at the boy in his lap. "I don't want to wake him." "Of course." Christina went to the sink, filled the glass, and returned, sitting down cross-legged opposite Mark. He took the glass with a grateful expression. "I'm sure Julian isn't that angry with you," she said. Mark made an inelegant noise, finishing the water and setting the glass down. "You could pick up Tavi," Christina suggested. "You could carry him to bed if you want him to sleep." "I like him here," Mark said, looking down at his own long, pale fingers tangled in the little boy's brown curls. "He just..." "They all left, and he fell asleep on me." He sounded amazed, wondering. "Of course he did," Christina said. "He's your brother. He trusts you." "Nobody trusts a hunter," Mark said. "You are not a hunter in this house. You are a Blackthorn." "I wish Julian agreed with you. I thought I was keeping the children happy. I thought that's what Julian would have wanted." Tavi shifted in Mark's arms, and Mark moved too, so that the edge of his boot was touching the tip of Christina's. She felt the contact like a small shock. "You have to understand," she said. "Julian does everything for these children, everything. I've never seen a brother who is so much like a parent. He cannot only tell them yes, he has to tell them no. He must deal in discipline and punishment and denial, whereas you can give them anything, you can have fun with them." "Julian can have fun with them," Mark said a little sulkily. "He can't," said Christina. "He is envious because he loves them, but he cannot be their brother. He must be their father. In his mind, they dread him and adore you." "Julian's jealous?" Mark looked astonished. "Of me?" "I think so." Christina met his eyes. At some point in knowing him, the mismatch between his blue and his golden one had stopped seeming strange to her. The same way it had stopped seeming strange to be in the Blackthorn's kitchen, speaking English instead of at home, where things were warm and familiar. "Be kind to him. He is a gentle soul. He's terrified you will leave and break the hearts of all these children he loves so very much." Mark looked down at Tavi. "I don't know what I will do," he said. "I did not realize how it would tear at my heart to be back among them. It was thinking of them, of my family, that helped me live through the first years I was in the hunt. Every day we would ride and steal from the dead. It was cold, a cold life. And at night I would lie down and conjure their faces to lull me to sleep. They were all I had until..." He broke off. Tavi sat up, scrubbing his small hands through his tangled hair. "Jules?" he yawned. "No," said his brother quietly. "It's Mark."
"Oh, right."
Tavi gave him a blink-eyed smile.
"Think I crashed from all the sugar."
"Well, you were inside a bag of it," Mark said. "That could have an effect on anyone." Tavi got to his feet and stretched. A full little boy stretch with his arms outraised. Mark watched him, a look of wistfulness in his eyes. Christina wondered if he was thinking about all the years and milestones he'd missed in Tavi's life. Of all his siblings, his youngest had changed the most. "Bed," Tavi said, and wandered out of the kitchen, pausing at the door to say, "Night, Christina," shyly, before scampering off. Christina turned back to Mark. He was still sitting with his back against the refrigerator. He looked exhausted, not just physically, but as if his soul were tired. She could get up and go to bed, Christina thought. She probably should. There was no reason for her to stay here and sit on the floor with a boy she barely knew, who would most likely disappear out of her life in months, and who was probably in love with someone else. Which, she thought, might be exactly what drew her to him. She knew what it was like to leave someone you loved behind. Until? She prompted. Mark's eyelids lifted slowly, showing her the banked fire and golden blue eyes. What? You said your family, the memory of your family, was all you had until something. Until Kieran? Yes, Mark said. Was he the only one who was kind to you? In the hunt? Said Mark. There is no kindness in the hunt. There is respect, and a sort of camaraderie of brothers. They feared Kieran, of course. Kieran is gentry, a prince of faerie. His father, the king, gave him to the hunt as a sign of goodwill to Gwyn, but he also demanded his good treatment. The good treatment was extended to me, but even before Kieran, they came slowly to respect me. His shoulders hunched. It was worst when we attended the revels. Fairies from all over would come to those, and they did not appreciate a shadow hunter's attendance. They would do their best to draw me aside, to taunt and torment me. Did no one intervene? Mark laughed shortly. The ways of fairy are brutal, he said. Even for the greatest among them. The queen of the Seelie court can be deprived of her powers if her crown is stolen. Even Gwyn, who leads the wild hunt, must yield authority to any who steals his cloak. You cannot imagine they would show mercy to a half-shadow hunter boy. His lip curled. They even had a rhyme they would mock me with. A rhyme? Christina held up a hand. Never mind. You do not need to tell it to me, not if you don't wish to. I no longer care, Mark said. It was an odd bit of doggerel. First the flame and then the flood. In the end, it's blackthorn blood. Christina sat up straight. What? They claimed it meant blackthorn blood was destructive, like flood or fire. That whoever made up the rhyme was saying blackthorns were bad luck. Not that it matters, it's just a bit of nonsense. That isn't nonsense, Christina exclaimed. It means something, the words written on the bodies. She frowned in concentration. They are the same. What do you mean? Fire to water, she said. It is the same, they are simply different translations. When English is not your first language, you understand the sense of the words differently. Believe me, fire to water and first the flame and then the flood, they could be the same thing. But what does that mean? I'm not sure. Christina pushed her hands into her hair in frustration. Please promise me you'll mention it to Emma and Jules as soon as you can. I could be wrong, but... Mark looked baffled. Yes, of course. Promise. Tomorrow, I promise. His smile was bemused. It occurs to me that you know a great deal about me, Christina, and I know very little about you. I know your name, Mendoza Rosales. I know you left something behind in Mexico. What was it? Not a something, she said. Someone. Perfect Diego. And his brother, Jaime. She waved away Mark's raised eyebrow. One of them I was in love with, and the other was my best friend. They both broke my heart. She was almost astonished to hear the words come out of her mouth. "For your heart twice broken, I am sorry," said Mark. "But is it wrong that I am glad that it brought you into my life? If you had not been here when I arrived, I do not know that I could have borne it. When I first saw Julian, I thought he was my father. I did not know my brother so grown. I left them children, and now they are no longer that. When I knew what I had lost, even with Emma, those years of their lives, you are the only one I have not lost something with, but rather gained a new friendship. Friendship, Christina agreed. He extended his hand and she looked at him bemused. It is traditional, he said, among the Fae, for a declaration of friendship to be accompanied by a clasp of hands. She put her hand in his fingers closed about her own. They were rough where they were calloused, but lithe and strong. And not cool as she had imagined they would be, but warm. She tried to hold back the shiver that threatened to spread up her arm, realizing how long it had been since she had held someone's hand like this. Christina, he said, and her name sounded like music when he spoke it.
Neither of them noticed the movement at the window, the flash of a pale face looking in, or the sound of an acorn being viciously crushed between narrow fingers. The large chamber inside the cave hadn't changed since the last time Emma had been in it. The same bronze walls, the same chalked circle on the floor. The same large glass doors fixed into the walls and wavering darkness behind them. Energy crackled against her skin as she walked into the circle. The magic of the glamour. From inside the circle, the room looked different. The walls seemed faded and flowing, as if they were in an old photograph. The porthole doors were dark. The circle itself was empty, though there was a strange smell inside it, a mixture of sulfur and burned sugar. Making a face, Emma stepped out of the circle and approached the leftmost porthole door. Up close, it no longer looked dark. There was a light behind it. It was illuminated from within, like a museum display. She stepped closer still and stared through the glass. Beyond the glass door was a small square space, like a closet. Inside it was a large brass candelabra, though there were no candles fastened to the holders. It would have made a wicked weapon, Emma thought, with its long spikes, meant to be jammed into soft wax. There was also a small pile of what looked to Emma like ceremonial clothes. A dark red velvet robe, a pair of long earrings that flashed with rubies, delicate gold sandals. Was the necromancer a woman? Emma stepped quickly to the second door. With her nose to the glass, she could see what looked like water. It surged and moved, and dark shapes slipped through it. One bumped against the glass, and she jumped back with a shout before realizing that it was only a small, striped fish with orange eyes. It gazed at her for a moment, before disappearing back into the dark water. She lifted her witch light close to the glass, and now the water was truly visible. It was radiant, a deep blue-green, the color of blackthorn eyes. She could see fish and drifting seaweed and strange lights and colors beyond the glass. Apparently they were dealing with a necromancer who liked aquariums and fish. Maybe even turtles. Shaking her head, Emma stepped back. Her eyes lit on the metal object fixed between the doors. At first she had thought it looked like a carved knife sticking out of the wall, but now she realized it was a lever. She reached out and closed her hand around it. It was cold under her fingers. She yanked it down. For a moment nothing happened, then both of the porthole doors swung wide. An unearthly howl tore through the room. Emma turned and stared in horror. The second portal was wide open and glowing bright blue, and Emma could see that it wasn't an aquarium at all. It was a door into the ocean. A great, deep universe of water opened on the other side of the door, of whipping seaweed and surging currents in the dark, shadowy shapes of things much bigger than fish. The stench of salt water was everywhere. Flood, Emma thought. And then she found herself lifted off her feet and dragged toward the ocean as if she were being sucked down a drain. She only had time to scream once before she was hauled through the doorway and the water closed over her head.
Cameron Ashdown.
Julian was painting. Christina had given him Emma's note after he'd left the attic. A terse note, to the point. Just saying she was going to Cameron's and not to wait up. He'd crumpled it up in his hand and muttered something to Christina. A second later, he was sprinting toward the stairs in his studio, ripping open his supply cabinet, tumbling out the paints, unzipping his gear jacket, throwing it down, yanking the caps off the tubes of oil paint and squeezing the colors onto the palette until the sharp smell of the paint filled the room and cut through the fog in his head. He attacked the canvas, holding the brush like a weapon, and the paint seemed to spill out of him like blood. He was painting in black and red and gold, letting the events of the past days drain out of him as if they were poisonous venom. The brush slashed across the blank canvas, and there was Mark on the beach, the moonlight shining across the vicious scars on his back. There was Ty with his knife to Kit Rook's throat, Tavi screaming with his nightmares, Mark cringing away from Julian Steely. He was aware he was sweating, his hair sticking to his forehead. He tasted salt and paint in his mouth. He knew he shouldn't be here. He should be doing what he always did, minding Tavi, finding new books to feed Ty's curiosity, putting healing runes on Livy when she cut herself fencing, sitting with Drew while she watched bad horror films. He should be with Emma. But Emma wasn't here.
She was off having her own life. And that was as it should be, as Parabatai were meant to be. It wasn't a marriage.